The T-Biz podcast delivers tea news that you need to know. A recap of the week's major headlines with commentary and cultural trends hosted by Dan Bolton. It is the voice of origin for tea professionals and enthusiasts worldwide.
Each year, the T-Biz portal publishes the State of the Tea Industry Forecast, a forward-looking assessment of production, pricing, trade, and demand. We invite tea professionals across the value chain to review the findings and contribute their perspective. Your insights help refine the forecast before it is finalized on March 1st.
Hello, everyone. Here are this week's headlines. The Middle East conflict has dramatically lowered Sri Lankan tea exports. Assam unrest has revealed deeper industry strains. And Turkish tea finds a bigger export market. Plus, the power of feedback. What if anonymous worker feedback became reliable and persuasive? Could feedback be powerful enough to reshape tea sourcing? For decades, ethical tea suppliers have relied on audits and certifications, but what if the people closest to production, the workers themselves, became the source of continuous improvement? Guy Chambers, former CEO of Findlay's, joins us today for a discussion about Glassmarks, a not-for-profit platform he founded designed around three simple ideas: safety, fairness, and voice. Workers complete a one-minute anonymous survey offered in 53 languages. The results are aggregated and shared to encourage continuous improvement. The idea is simple. Could worker feedback become an information layer that tea has been missing? Stay tuned. More in a minute, but first, this important message.
What makes a perfect cup of Ceylon tea? The perfect cup is from the tea businesses that ensure the protection of all the children living within their tea estates. We salute Keilani Valley, Telawakili, Bogawanthalawa, Harana, and Eliptia Tea Estates. Support Save the Children, Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka tea exports are down sharply as the industry faces a growing challenge that has little to do with weather, crop yields, or auction performance. Instead, the issue is market concentration. Reuters reports that Sri Lanka's tea export earnings fell more than 17% in March compared to a year earlier. Shipments to Iraq declined 38%, while exports to the United Arab Emirates fell an astonishing 93%. Those numbers matter because the Middle East remains the most important export region for Ceylon tea. Iraq was Sri Lanka's largest tea market in 2025, importing more than 39 million kilograms. The UAE imported roughly 21 million kilograms and serves as a critical trading, blending, warehousing, and redistribution hub for tea that moves throughout the Gulf, North Africa, and parts of Central Asia. For decades, Sri Lankan exporters built strong commercial relationships across Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and other Gulf markets. That strategy helped support export growth and premium pricing. But recent events are revealing the risks of relying heavily on a single region. When geopolitical instability rises, the impact extends well beyond shipping. Buyers become cautious. Banks tighten credit. Insurance costs rise. Importers delay purchases. Currency volatility increases. In other words, tea demand can weaken even if the ports remain open. The challenges amplify because these markets account for more than one-third of Sri Lanka's tea exports by volume and an even larger share of export earnings. Outside the Middle East, Sri Lanka maintains important positions in Russia, Central Asia, and Europe, where buyers continue to favor orthodox black teas. North America remains a much smaller market, but one that purchases higher-value pocket tea, specialty tea, and branded teas. While the United States and Canada cannot replace Middle Eastern demand overnight, they represent some of the industry's most promising long-term growth opportunities. Meanwhile, Colombo auction demand has remained reasonably firm, and policymakers continue discussing reforms that could give exporters more flexibility in how tea is marketed and sold through direct purchases. The larger lesson is strategic. Tea companies often talk about diversifying sourcing origins. This situation shows that market diversification may be just as important. For Sri Lanka, the challenge over the coming months will be maintaining market share in the Middle East while accelerating efforts to develop alternative destinations for Ceylon tea. Business insight. The tea trade tends to focus on prediction risk, drought in Kenya, labor unrest in Assam, and frost in China. But this week's Sri Lanka story is a reminder that customer concentration can be just as dangerous as crop concentration. A tea exporter with 40% of sales tied to a single region is exposed to forces beyond its control. The lesson extends beyond Sri Lanka. Export diversification is no longer simply a growth strategy. It is becoming a risk management strategy. Companies that develop multiple destination markets before disruptions occur will be far more resilient than those forced to diversify after a crisis begins. Tea workers protesting across several estates in Assam made headlines this week, but the demonstrations revealed something larger than a labor dispute. Thousands of workers at five Dabugra tea gardens have raised concerns about wages, housing, health care, and working conditions. Labor tensions are not new to Assam, but the protests come at a particularly sensitive moment for India's largest tea-producing region. Reports indicated organized protests and road blockades, but no major injuries, fatalities, or widespread violence. Behind the unrest is a growing list of pressures affecting the competitiveness of Assam tea. One source of controversy remains India's tea auction reforms. Earlier this year, the Tea Board closed the Jorhat Tea Auction Center and continues to enforce mandatory digital auction requirements. Supporters say the reforms improve transparency and traceability, while critics argue that they reduce marketing flexibility and make it harder for producers to negotiate directly with buyers. At the same time, export markets are becoming more challenging. Instability in the Middle East is disrupting buying patterns across some of the world's largest tea-consuming regions. Importers facing uncertainty over shipping, financing, insurance costs, and consumer demand are becoming more cautious. Sri Lanka is currently the most exposed, but Indian exporters are closely monitoring developments. Europe poses another challenge. Enforcement of existing maximum residue levels, MRLs, is increasingly strict. European buyers are demanding more residue testing, traceability, and compliance documentation before committing to purchases. For exporters unable to consistently meet these requirements, access to premium markets is becoming more difficult and more expensive. Meanwhile, competition is intensifying closer to home. Improving trade relations with Nepal are facilitating greater movement of tea across the border. Nepal's orthodox tea sector continues to expand and gain recognition among international buyers. With lower cost and improving quality, Nepalese teas are creating additional competition in premium categories traditionally associated with Darjeeling and parts of Assam. None of these issues alone threatens Assam's standing as one of the world's great tea-producing regions. Together, however, they create a more challenging operating environment than many producers have faced in years. The question is not whether Assam can produce world-class tea. It is whether the region can adapt quickly enough to remain competitive in a rapidly changing global market. Turkey's tea sector is experiencing record exports. According to the Eastern Black Sea Exporters Association, Turkey exported more than 6,200 tons of tea last year, generating $34.8 million. That marked a 25% increase in volume and a 38% increase in value. Turkish tea reached 122 countries last year. The sales office in Belgium alone accounted for $12.7 million in purchases. The United Kingdom followed at $5.8 million, and Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus purchased $2.6 million. Those numbers are small compared with the world's largest tea exporters, but they matter because Turkey has historically been a domestic tea market first. Turks drink enormous quantities of black tea, and most Turkish tea is consumed at home. The state-controlled company, Kakur, has long played a stabilizing role in the eastern Black Sea region, buying leaf from thousands of small farmers and supporting rural incomes in Rize, Trabzon, Artvin, and Giresun. But the export strategy is changing. Turkey's not trying to compete with Kenya or Sri Lanka at a low-cost bulk supplier. Its production costs are too high and domestic demand is too strong. Instead, exporters are pushing branded, packaged, and higher-value tea into markets where Turkish identity matters. Europe is central to that strategy. Belgium is not only a major supplier, but it also acts as a distribution hub into Germany, France, and the Netherlands. The UK is another important market, and Turkish exporters are also targeting the Middle East, North America, and Asia Pacific. The strategic point is that Turkey is using exports to increase per kilogram value, not merely to move surplus tea. For Kakur and private exporters, the next stage is to deepen retail and wholesale relationships, especially in Europe, and to expand beyond diaspora demand. Turkey's tea export growth is still in its early stages, but the direction is clear. A tea industry built to serve domestic drinkers is now learning how to sell origin, identity, and brand value abroad. Business Insight. Turkey's tea export gains were gradual, not sudden. Export revenue rose from just $13 million in 2018 to nearly $35 million in 2025. After a pandemic-era boost and a brief slowdown in volume in 2023, exporters shifted towards higher value sales and broader distribution across Europe. Belgium became central to that strategy, serving as both Turkey's largest buyer and a gateway to the broader European market. The result is export revenue now recorded for an industry once focused almost exclusively on meeting Turkey's remarkable consumption, which averages 10 cups per person per day in the winter months. The Week 21 Tea Price Report for the period ending May 22nd is sponsored by the East Africa Tea Trade Association, EATTA, owners of the Mombasa Tea Auction since 1956. Tea markets closed Week 21 with functional demand but wider separation between quality teas and secondary descriptions. The market's not distressed, but it is more selective. Colombo saw fair demand, though the total sale average eased from the previous week. North India remained active, especially for improved teas and dusts, but sale 21 averages moved lower from sale 20. Mombasa stayed orderly against the latest available official benchmark, while Indonesia showed the clearest demand tone, with Van Rees reporting good demand for the week. In Colombo, prices averaged $3.62 a kilo this week, down 20 cents versus the previous week in sale 19 and 20 in May 2026. In North India, prices averaged $2.47 per kilo this week, down 13 cents per kilo versus reconstructed price auction benchmark for sale 20. In Mombasa, prices averaged $2.18 a kilo this week, which was the same as last available gauge of ETA sale 17 in CTC. In Indonesia, prices averaged $2.41 per kilo this week, the same as the prior benchmark. Structural drivers remain familiar. Buyers are covering need, not building speculative positions. Exporters are defending price where quality allows, and cost pressure from freight, energy, and remains a swing factor, especially for lower-value teas. The takeaway, Week 21 was not a broad price collapse week. It was a quality selection week with better teas still supported and weaker descriptions forced to meet the market. That's the TBiz Price Report for Week 21, ending 22 May 2026. Subscribe for free to the TBiz newsletter on LinkedIn for a detailed regional breakdown, 6-month trade signals, and near-term outlook for quarter two pricing dynamics. And now, a word from this week's sponsor.
Hello, I'm Bogdan, a passionate tea drinker and the inventor of the ultimate tea machine, the Brewmaker One. Preparation is key to making fine tea. Sequential steepings deliver the best taste possible and unlock the true value of whole leaf teas and botanicals. Brew automates that process without using any pots or capsules. This simple-to-operate smartphone-controlled device stores steeping profiles to consistently make great tea at the push of a button. Brew also reduces time, waste, and energy. That's because I engineered the brew to remember control settings for temperature, brewing time, and quantity. Using my patented process lets you stack steeps simply and conveniently.
What if anonymous worker feedback became reliable and pervasive? Could feedback be powerful enough to reshape tea sourcing? For decades, ethical tea relied on audits and certifications. But what if the people closest to production, the workers themselves, became the source of continuous improvement? Welcome to the Tea Biz Spotlight. Today we're speaking with Guy Chambers, founder of Glassmarks and former CEO of Findlay's. Glassmarks is a not-for-profit platform designed around three simple ideas: safety, fairness, and voice. Workers complete a one-minute anonymous survey in 53 languages. The results are aggregated and shared to encourage continuous improvement. The idea is simple. Could worker feedback become an information layer that tea has been missing? Glassmarks founder and executive chairman Guy Chambers has spent more than three decades in the global beverage industry, including leadership roles in China's ready-to-drink tea sector and as a former CEO of Findlay's. His current work focuses on building transparency, worker feedback systems, and continuous improvement models for supply chains. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Guy. You've spent decades in beverages and tea. What convinced you that the industry needed a different approach?
It's a great question, and it's a very important question as well. So my background is about 33 years now in the beverage industry. About 20 years of that was in China, actually as a Coke bottler. So I was sort of building Coca-Cola business as a franchisee bottler and setting up bottling facilities, then setting up route to market and bottling Coca-Cola products for the Chinese masses, and then moved over to the tea side and sort of bought a Chinese tea company for an investor. And we were supplying all the big tea RTD players in China. And then I went to be CEO of Findlay's. So that was, again, back in tea, doing global tea supply for big brand owners. And I left, as you probably know, 3-4 years ago, I left to set up my own business. And the real motivation behind that, a lot of it was really driven by sitting in sometimes industry meetings where people are very aware of the challenges that the tea industry has, but and talking about problems such as, you know, information transparency, you know, revealing where tea comes from, kind of legacy practices of power relationships in plantations. How do you actually address these things? You know, maybe it's me, but I was just getting very frustrated with it and thought, so there was lots of conversations, but very little action.
You describe an information layer that disappeared during industrialization. What do you mean by that?
So with Rainforest Alliance falling apart, there's this kind of big disconnect between what consumers are expecting or wanting, at least in the global north. It may not be, it's not universal. And I admit, you know, traders in Pakistan who are selling tea off into Afghanistan will be having different criteria to the ones we're talking about today. But in the global north, consumers are expecting their tea to be produced ethically. And they've been living in a vacuum, information vacuum, for 30 years where they've been given public commitments. Yeah. But they have no clarity and no certainty about the execution against those commitments. And the old ways of doing things with social audits don't work. We know that from all the experiences of the sort of the BBC Panorama thing a couple of years ago, where all these places actually were pretty well-run companies, relatively speaking, but still had issues. And we kind of said, look, why don't we start by designing it completely the other way around? You know, just do everything back to front. If it was done in a way in the past, we'll just do the opposite as a starting idea. So we said, well, we need to start not top down, but bottom up.
Yeah.
You know, start with the employees. If we're talking about working conditions, then the most important stakeholder in all of this has got to be workers. So start with the workers, start with the employees. Make it really, really simple to use. Make it intuitive. Reduce friction on getting people on the system and starting to use it. And we were saying, well, okay, how do you keep it really simple? And we looked around a little bit and said, actually, you know, most companies have signed up to, generally speaking, the same 9 or 10 commitments on ethical working conditions or labor conditions. Okay. There's the Ethical Trading Initiative base code from about 30 years ago. It's now seeped into commitments from every company, you know, whether it's the UK retailers or brand owners or even the US ones, you know, all the US retailers have the same kind of core commitments. And we said, okay, well, let's start with that. So let's start with the 9 questions or 10 questions around that. Keep it very binary, very simple, yes, no. Then there was a big aha moment, which is, again, when we're kind of thinking, doing the opposite of what's happened in the past. We said, what about making the information, making the results public? Mm-hmm. Because in the past, these audit results are always private. So we thought, well, what's the pros and cons of making it public? And if you make it public, there's a couple of things. One is it actually makes the worker feel a bit more empowered because it's almost like a collective voice. That's the sort of logic behind that. And that collective voice is also super useful for other people in the ecosystem, buyers.
That's where the discussion starts to shift. Glassmarks is not trying to measure tea quality directly. It starts somewhere more fundamental. Why focus on working conditions first rather than quality metrics or sustainability indicators?
I think it may help if I put this in what we're talking about in a slightly broader context, which is that you can kind of break down. I mean, it relates to a far bigger story, which is about how human civilization evolved. The story has 3 chapters. The first chapter was, you know, hundreds of years ago, we all knew where our food was coming from. We all knew where our basic necessities like clothing and shelter came from because all those things were local. Then we moved into the second chapter, which is started a couple of hundred years ago, where we see the introduction of manufactured items or traded items. And, you know, tea and spices are actually one of those very early traded items. But the distance between the consumer and the producer started getting further and further. You know, so as industrialization happened, people came off the countryside, they came off the farms, they went into factory jobs, and they no longer knew where food came from.
Right.
They no longer knew where their clothes came from because there was all division of labor. That kind of social contract, almost, that when things are being produced, you knew how they were being produced and the impact that was being generated. You know, you knew was your farmer treating their employee, the farmer in your next door neighbor, were they treating their employees well? You knew that because you were seeing them every day.
Right.
All of a sudden, when the farm was hundreds of miles away or thousands of miles away, you no longer knew that. And that layer, if you take a product, the product has 3 layers. There's a kind of qualitative or functional layer. You know, this is tea. It's a beverage. It has some sensory dimension to it. There's that physical layer. You have an economic layer, which is price. What do you pay to get that physical item? But there's also an information layer.
Mm-hmm.
And that information layer, you didn't need to capture that data when it was in your next door neighbor's field. But during the Industrial Revolution, that information layer basically got stripped away. You know, it fell apart.
Right.
But that information layer, which is where is it from? How is it made? that disappeared. So that information layer, which where is it from? How is it made? Was it made ethically? What is the impact of that? You know, how much water was used to make it? That's the second chapter. We're beginning to move from the second chapter into the third chapter of the story, which is that people actually want to know the information layer. They want to know the story. They want to know, was it produced ethically? They want to know, what kind of impact does it have? And there are now devices flying around. You know, we all have these in our pockets,
right,
that allow data capture, data dissemination, data aggregation, and data receival in a very different way that has never existed in history before. So it is the data collection that is happening inside GlassMax is focused solely on the working conditions. And that is selected for a very simple reason, which is, as we were talking about earlier, you know, in the information layers, there's actually lots of layers of information. It's not just one item of data. There's working conditions. There's you know, plucking standards. There's factory operating standards. There's carbon usage, carbon footprints. There's water usage. There's regenerative agriculture. You name it. There's a long list of broad items of information which will be useful to know. However, what we're doing, though, is starting something which is a new communication channel. And we are signaling something which has not been signaled before. And in our approach has been, if you're doing something new, you have to keep the signal simple.
Right.
So if you're sending lots of messages at the same time in a new way, then the likelihood of failure increases exponentially. And the foundational element is human rights, labor conditions.
Yeah.
Because this is kind of what a lot of ESG people talk about, but we're influenced by different writers on this one and different academics, but they often kind of come back and say, look, the absolute foundational one is human rights. Because if you're not doing that properly, then you're highly unlikely to be doing the other things properly either. You know, if you can't treat your fellow human today with respect and do what you've publicly committed to do, well, what you publicly committed decades ago to do, if you're still not doing that today to an human individual today, then the chances are you won't be doing the right stuff to the environment, which where the impact will not be seen for another 5 years or 10 years. So that human piece is absolutely the cornerstone of where GlassMark starts. It says, look, let's just start at the most primary layer, which is around human rights, but you know, workers' rights in the workplace. And if we can join that pipe up and get transparency in a new way, which hasn't been done before, then we may come back to the other ones later.
Can GlassMark become a daily management tool rather than another audit system?
Yes. Yeah, the whole idea of GlassMark is that it has to be, it has to be valuable locally.
Right.
It isn't data input today for someone thousands of miles away. This is feedback locally in order to improve locally. So it's supporting the feedback loop inside an organization, inside a factory, inside a workplace, between people doing the work and people managing people doing the work. But the issue is, how do you make it work locally in the single site? And the feedback loop essentially does a couple of things. Number one, it collates the kind of general view of your workforce on some of these basic work conditions based on the kind of ethical criteria and yes, no answers. That's one part. The second part is there's a improvement feedback channel. So any worker can put an input on an opportunity for improvement or a problem that they have highlighted that they've seen in the workplace. And then the third thing is a secure private messaging system for grievances. So if something has happened of a serious nature, and, you know, this does happen, unfortunately, where is it a criminal offense or a human rights abuse or sexual abuse, God forbid, these kinds of things happen. And how do you make that as easy as possible for the individual to report anonymously to a trusted place? So Glassbox includes that functionality as well. It uses the technology which is available so that on one side of the employee is anonymous. They don't have to set up their phone number. They don't have to set up an email address. They remain 100% anonymous, and they can sort of start a secure private message just like on WhatsApp, but they are anonymous, and the message goes to a designated guardian to then follow up and respond. And that communication then can go backwards and forwards, and you can attach, you can attach files or photos or images. We're now introducing some voice functions to it as well, if people have lower literacy. So that is very much internal, the internal feedback and improvement loop, continuous improvement loop for daily management and operational management within a work site. So that's a core part of it. We want to make it easier for people to provide the feedback, but it easier for management to then act upon it. But that cycle has to work as a cycle. If people are putting feedback in, but the management are not listening, or they're not willing to improve or take suggestions or try and at least engage to make the improvements where they've been highlighted, the thing's going to collapse. So I think we're being very realistic, and we are aiming to work with companies who are already doing a good job, who are already probably above average on this, already committed to continuous improvement. And we're trialing it with them to say, how can we help you do this easier? How do you use technology today to help do this easier?
You've said the workers' changing rooms often reveal more than the PowerPoint presentation. Explain that.
I've been running factories for years and visiting factories for years. It boils down to, there's one or two things that if I'm going on any factory visit, I will always ask at some point during the tour. And I will ask to go and see the workers' toilets and the workers' changing rooms. And you can have a really pretty, amazing tour with fantastic PowerPoints and very impressive information shared about generative agriculture and AI this and drone that and the other. When it came around to, we did a due diligence visit, and at the very end of walking around, spending half a day, they said, anything else you'd like to see? And I said, yeah, could you please show me the workers' changing rooms and bathroom facilities? First of all, the person running the business didn't know where they were. And when the person then had to ask where they were, and that individual had been there 5 years, so that's pretty criminal in my view. But when they then asked where they were and were taken to them, surprise, surprise, they were appalling. They were really, really bad. And that, I think, sends a really symbolic message, which is we don't really care about that. If you want to have a continuous improvement, culture in a business, looking after employees on some really basic things like, give them some clean changing facilities, give them a place to have a shower, give them uniforms which can get washed by the company so they can go home in their own clean, in their own clothes and not have to wear dirty uniforms. And give them a lockable locker to put their stuff in during the day. These are really, really basic things which do not cost a lot of money. If you're not doing that stuff, then a lot of the other stuff above that is just built on quicksand. And so this survey, actually, the Glassmark survey, very first question is, do you have access to clean water and toilet?
Yeah, because, when that answer is no.
Yeah.
That's where you have to start.
Management is about prioritization. So what are you going to do? That's where you're going to start. Let's focus on get that right first, and then we'll go back to the other things.
Could Glassmark's influence buyer behavior?
Simple answer to that is yes. And that Glassmark's is, if it's successful and if it starts getting traction, is potentially a signaling layer. I mean, whether it's benchmarking or signaling, it's a similar kind of thing, but primarily it's a signaling layer to help decision making. And that decision making is both for management of the working, you know, of that workplace, because they're getting feedback on how to improve or what areas to improve locally for management. And it's also signaling for buyers. So it's signaling externally to folks out in the market, whether they are brand owners or retailers, of it's adding a layer of information that they can look between sites and start having a more rich idea of the working conditions in those different sites. And that's the kind of basic idea. It's a signaling layer. And the more sites that use the tool, obviously the richer the information for people looking at it. We're very conscious that what we want to try and do is remove friction to adoption. So making it easy as possible for users to use it, to make it really simple. Remove friction for companies to sign up to use it by making it really useful for the company internally and making it value for money. This is not, you know, the cost of subscribing to this we've kept extremely low. And because the idea is we want as many places to adopt it as possible and start going down that improvement journey. Is it a competitive signal? Yeah, realistically, yeah. I mean, if people are doing things better than each other, you know, better than your next door neighbor, then, and you can use that as a selling point, then Glassbox can help communicate that, can help signal that.
Technology is only part of the challenge. Trust may be the harder issue. What have you learned about adoption in tea origin markets?
Yeah, so you've hit the nail on the head, Dan, as usual. You know, this is an important question and a difficult one. First of all, it's not, you know, the barrier is not a technology issue. This isn't a technology right. problem. You can build a tool, but the question is, for the tool to be effective, it has to fit, it has to work in the social environment that it's been designed for. In this case, the context of what we're trying to do is really, really important. And the technology has been developed. We from very, very early in the development of this, it was field tested in tea factories. And so quite early on in the development, it was put in users' hands to understand, you know, can the average tea worker in Creature use this, for example? And understood, you know, is the workflow simple enough to understand? Is this difficult to use? Do you need, the idea was we didn't want any configuration and any training. So can you give it to someone? And we specifically didn't create a training manual or set up training sessions for the users. The very, very first batch of users, we specifically didn't give them any training just to see what would happen.
So it's just as simple as pulling a phone out, getting to the URL, and you're in business.
It tries to get zero friction. So you get sent a link by WhatsApp and you're off. Yeah. So it's figuring out how does that then fit? The more complicated challenge is, how does that information then fit in the relationship between your workers and your management? Because it's got to be a flow, as we talked about before. There's got to be a feedback loop there. So in places where the power distance between workers and management is very, very small, you know, for example, if you're in a tea farm in Taiwan or a tea farm in Japan, that information is kind of the management link between the employee and the owner is very close. And so that's not a difficult one to get that feedback loop happening in. But as you know, the power distance in places like large scale tea estates, Kenya or Tanzania or Rwanda, that is a lot more complex. So we have chosen specifically to, in the places where there are larger scale tea estates, we are only targeting and working with owners which we already know are highly committed to this and committed to continuous improvement, are really committed to be doing the right thing in their working environment. And that's not every single tea estate owner. You know, we have selected and are in the discussions with and doing these trials with what we think are sort of the more sort of forward-looking, future-looking, longer-term, truly sustainable owners of these businesses and getting it to work for in those environments. Because it has to be a management team and an owner who's committed to doing the right thing and listening to that feedback so that it's going to be...
Right.
It's not the tool itself, by itself, is not going to solve the problem. The tool has to be embedded in a culture where they're willing to use that information to improve the business. So that's the kind of the key thing, you know, keep it simple for the worker side, keep it anonymous for the worker. And on the management side, make it useful, make the information useful as part of the continuous improvement process. Use the data to help create some management dashboards more easily, so it's easier to manage the process. And then incentivize good performance. And you incentivize good performance by buyers being more interested in the places doing this. You know, we'll focus on the better places, get them started first. And then potentially other places would get interested. And then there'll be some kind of division of the world where some factory owners decide, yeah, if they want to serve the global north, this is what they're going to have to do. Or if they're just happier selling to Pakistan or Russia or something, maybe they don't need to have the same levels of compliance, and they just come off some of the certification systems because they're not necessary for those markets. So the implications, I think, we'll only really know once folks are using it, but I think it may have a knock-on impact on how the industry is structured, because it will be a point of difference for people who are meeting those commitments. Some of them are meeting them today, but it's simply not being recognized for it. We wanted to find a word to help describe some kind of signifier. The idea sort of popped into someone's head during all of this, where we said, look, how about you have a marker and glass is transparent. It helps you see through things. But as you may have seen from the Glassmark site, and if you played around on the maps at all, the glass marks change color. So they start as clear, and then depending on the score, they change color, and they are either red if it's low scores, amber if they are kind of medium scores, average scores, or green if they are high scoring. And that's a very simple kind of traffic light system that the glass mark itself changes color over, you know, as a result of the feedback and the data coming into it. So input data gets aggregated and then gets converted into a number, the percentage number, but then also changes the color of this score. So it's about creating a marker, which is almost a dynamic marker, allowing transparency. And so this, it started as another word, actually, which then didn't land particularly well. And then it was like, and sometimes a lot of innovations, it popped out in the middle of the night, one night, and it kind of stuck. So it's just a very simple focus on one concept of that glass mark.
Glassmarks proposes a simple idea. Make invisible conditions visible, turn worker voice into signals, and create incentives for continuous improvement. Our guest today was Guy Chambers, founder of Glassmarks. You can learn more at glassmarks.org. That's glassmarks.org.
Intrigued by what you heard in today's podcast? Would you like to learn more from our global network of T-Biz journalists and T-experts? Remember to visit the T-Biz website for more comprehensive coverage. That's www.t-biz.com. Thanks for listening. Farewell till next week.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.